Okay, great. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming out to learn. I was asked to speak a little bit about kosher, right? That's the topic for tonight. So we titled it, Why Keep Kosher, to understand the sources. You know, what is kosher all about? So there's a little bit of a double-edged sword. Let me explain what I mean by that. Whenever we try to understand the reason for any one of Hashem's mitzvot, it's great, but on the other hand, it could be a pitfall. Because if I take the reason for a mitzvah and I say that's the only reason for the mitzvah, well, I just limited it. And any time that reason falls away or I can come up with a different reason, then I could, God forbid, limit the application of the mitzvah. So, for example, people have approached the keeping kosher and say it just means clean meat, right? So if I can get the USDA to, tell me that pig is a clean animal and I'll make sure there's no bacteria, there's no disease in it, it's okay, pig is now kosher. That's obviously not true. So we have to work out and figure out what are some of the reasons for the mitzvah of kashrut. How does it work? What do the sources tell us about it? But on the other hand, not to get too carried away with it at the end of the day, there's a play on words. The way you say reason for something in Hebrew is a ta'am. So what's the ta'am? What's the reason for the mitzvah? But ta'am could also mean the taste. So it's a funny thing to think about. It's, you know, keeping kosher, and the word reason and the word for taste is the exact same with the tongue. So they make a play on words. They said, you're nice. I give you all the reasons, but really it's just to give you a taste of the mitzvah. Whatever reasons I'm going to give you, it's nice, but if it doesn't taste well, like chocolate, like vanilla, I'm like a strawberry kind of person, whatever reason you give me, and if it doesn't fit, that's okay, because the mitzvah still stands on its own. All we're going to do is present some possible explanations, understandings about the mitzvot in general first, then we'll try to pull it together for kashrut. So the first thing, I based the sources I put together from an excellent workbook. It's like a book about teaching the laws from Rabbi Yosef Tzvi Rimon. He's a famous educator who lives now in Israel. When you went to Israel last summer, did you go to the south at all? No, okay, so...
We went to the Dead Sea.
You went to the Dead Sea. You got the store where they give you like all the creams and all the, okay, I know. Okay, so the first one's the Rambam. The Rambam, we heard of the Maimonides before? The Rambam was a famous rabbi, physician. He lived in Egypt. He was actually the court physician for the Sultan. He was the Jewish doctors. They do well, right? So he was the head. He writes in one of his letters about his grueling, excruciating schedule for daily. He had to examine everybody. By the end of the day, he came home to teach his students. He was so tired, he had to teach them lying down. He was just mamish knocked out from all of his long day. But Rambam writes a book of halacha, and he's talking in a particular context. Where it's from and where it's located is not so essential for our discussion, but he's just talking about trying to understand the reason behind mitzvot in general. So in the first source, it's appropriate for a person to meditate on the judgments of the Holy Torah. You should think about it. What are the laws? And to know their ultimate purpose according to his capacity. If he cannot find a reason or a motivating rationale for practice, he should not regard it lightly. You know, if I can't understand a mitzvah, that doesn't mean that the mitzvah is worthless, God forbid. It means that I wasn't able in my limited human intellect to understand what was going on here. Reminds me of a story. There was a man who was once at the famous museum in Paris where the Mona Lisa is on display. What's it called? Louvre. So he's there, and the guy's looking at it for like 2 hours. It's like staring at it. And the guard comes over, and the security says, "Excuse me, sir, what are you doing?" So the man, the true story, says to the guard, I'm trying to find out, you know, what's so good about it? Like, what's so great about this piece?" So the guard turned and said, "Sir, this is a classic of Western art. This painting is not on trial in the museum. You are. Can you appreciate what the Mona Lisa is?" So let's just start off the discussion by explaining the mitzvah of kashrus is not on trial here. We are. Can we understand what some lessons are about keeping kosher and why it's so important, what the beauty and the sensitivity is? Because at first of all, who needs laws about how I eat? If you stop the person, your regular Joe on the street, and say, "Excuse me, define for me holiness." Say, praying a lot, doing acts of kindness, learning Torah. Eating? That's not on the radar. That has nothing to do with living a holy lifestyle. Everything depends upon how we eat. And I'll show you as we go through the sources. So it continues the Rambam. I'm just reading it in the next part. "How much more so with regards to the mitzvah which God ordained for us, should a person not treat them derisively? Because he doesn't understand the rationale. He should not conjure matters that are not true concerning God, nor should he think about them with his mind as with ordinary matters." You know, if my wife, I love my wife, she tells me to do something and I don't understand exactly what she meant, okay, so I don't understand, I'm a guy, fine. But when Hashem tells me something, I shouldn't think, oh, Just like I don't understand my wife, I don't understand God. No. There's an ant? Does a fly, like when NASA's doing a space shuttle launching, do they understand what went into the equations and the physics and all the laws that went into making, to putting a person up in outer space? Of course not. So that gap that exists between the mosquito and the rocket scientist, literally, so that's nothing compared to the gap between human intellect and God's intellect. So we have to approach it with a sense of humility whenever we try to. And that's what the Rambam's telling us. The Rambam's telling us that, you know, well, let me read you a quote. I didn't put it on the source sheet, but I saw this in Rabbi Ramon's book. He reads, this is from Dr. Isidore Grunfeld. Our youth, especially our intelligentsia, must know that not only what they require to observe, but why. That, however, does not mean that adherence to our religious laws could or should be made dependent on our finding reasons for them acceptable to us. For that would result in the finite human mind sitting in judgment over the laws of God, the infinite mind and absolute being. Such an undertaking would contradict the age-old fundamental Sinai principle of Na'aseh V'Nishma. Did anybody talk about Na'aseh V'Nishma for Shavuot? Do you remember that? Oh, so let me explain what he's referencing to. Na'aseh V'Nishma was the finest hour of the Jewish people. When God offered the Torah, everyone else wanted to know, so what's written in there? It says you can't kill. It's like, I'm sorry, it's I don't beat white people, I kill them. What else is in there? You have to have a moral lifestyle. I'm sorry, we're very promiscuous. I can't take this mitzvah. Only the Jewish people said, Na'aseh V'Nishma. We're going to do it. And now afterwards, once we've committed, we're going to do whatever you want, God, because we know you only have our best interest in mind. And then V'Nishma, then we'll listen. Then we'll learn what are the mitzvot, what's Shabbos, what's keeping kosher, what are all the mitzvot. We'll learn about that afterwards. But first thing, Na'aseh V'Nishma. So what the Dayan is saying is that it's nice to have reasons, but we can never ever hold Hashem accountable if we, in our puny, finite intellect, can't understand God's master plan, right? When I was a kid, yeah, sure.
I'm sorry. So the nishma part of it is that's about listening.
You yes, said? Yeah. Nishma yeah, comes with word shema.
Does that also have to do
welcome,
with,
welcome, come.
Yeah, come like,
okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Does that also have to do with? Is that the same word as neshama, like your soul?
Oh, good. It's a good question. They sound the same, but they're not. Because I speak no, okay. I speak Hebrew funny. But if it was more accurate, I would articulate that the nishma is with an ayin at the end, okay. And neshama is with a hey at the end.
Oh, okay.
So,
but it sounds
a lot alike.
Okay.
Sounds like right.
The same?
No, it's not. They sound the same, but again, it's my California accent that comes through in Hebrew. They sound the same, but they're not the same. Shira, you could join us. My daughter just walked in. Okay, let me do the next one. The next Rambam. There's a category of laws. Let me get a little bit of background for this. There's categories of laws that if God didn't command them to us, you could totally figure them out on your own. What would be an example of something? If it wasn't a mitzvah, you and I would just sit down and say, it's obvious. Give me an example of one of them. Don't steal, right? It's obvious, okay? You know, I have my possessions, you have your possessions. Right? It's morally wrong to steal. So there's a category of those that really, if God didn't give us, I would have figured that out. There's some that God gave them to me, and I might have never thought of it on my own. But once I understand it, okay, it makes sense. And there's a category of laws called chukim, which is beyond any rational understanding. I can't give a good explanation for why God prohibited wearing wool and linen clothing together, shatnez. I don't know. I can't necessarily understand certain complicated laws, and we're not supposed to. So the Rambam here is referring to those categories, those that are called chukim, they're just beyond them. So if you look in the next source, it says, although all the statutes of the Torah decrees, as we explained in the conclusion of Hilchot Me'ilah, wow, that was the last source we saw, funny, it's fit to meditate upon them, and whenever it's possible to provide a reason, one should provide a reason. The sages of the early generations said that King Solomon, right, we've heard of King Solomon, right, who's his father? King Solomon's father was, do you know this? Mera, who? King David understood that most of the rationals for all the statutes of the Torah. All of these ordinances are to subjugate one's evil inclination and to improve one's character. So that's what the mitzvot do to us. They refine us. They cause us to become more sensitive people, whether we realize it or not. But it comes to, I'm quoting the Rambam, to subjugate our evil inclination. Similarly, most of the Torah's laws are nothing other than, quote, counsels given from a distance from he who is of great counsel to improve one's character and to make one's conduct upright. Okay, so even if I don't understand necessarily the reason for a mitzvah, this one, I just don't get it. Like, it doesn't, I, just, I, I, I don't understand why I have to wear tzitzit, why I have to put these boxes on my arm called tefillin, why I have to eat matzah on Pesach. I don't know these things. I don't understand. I remember in my Rebbe's sukkah, right? We're from, I'm just assuming we know what a sukkah is, right? For a sukkah. Okay, so we're sitting around, and he liked to get everybody involved in the conversation. And everyone around the table said, like, what mitzvah they found personally the hardest to observe. So it was eye-opening. What mitzvah? And one woman said, I find it very difficult to eat matzah on Passover. And I was a little bit surprised, because I don't know, that's not like, that's telling I'm on the top 10 of most fruit, you know? You know, it's good, right? You're a little cream cheese sandwich, whatever. But for this woman, you know, why not? For this woman, that was hard for her, right? So, everybody has their own levels. You know, there was a great Hasidic rabbi called the Kotzker, and he said, you know, spirituality, growth in Judaism is like a ladder. And it does not matter what rung you're on. It matters how many steps you take on that ladder. So hey, we give a great parable. He says, imagine, here's my ladder of spirituality. I look and I see two people on it. One person is on rung number 7, and one person's on rung number 52. So he says, you look at it, the ladder of spirituality, so who's higher, who's more spiritual? Well, obviously, that's a no-brainer. The person who's up on 52. The person who's on 7 is lower on the ladder. He says, no, the Kotzker says, it all depends what direction they're traveling. If the person on 52 is coming down, and the person on 7 is going up, so then who's really higher, right? You have to know that we have to learn the mitzvahs. We have to do as much as we can on our level. So for this woman, I remember years ago, still the memories stuck with me. So her matzah was her issue she's working on. For other people's kashas, everybody has their own pekalach. Everyone has their own bags of things that they're trying to work on. But I want to show you now a little history. Restrictions on food always existed from the beginning of time. God's master plan. I think we talked about this. Remember earlier we talked about, we did with the story of Adam and Eve, right, about eating from that, not to eat from food. So really God's master plan was not to have a Judaism. It was to have an entire world serving him. So he tried once with Adam and Eve, and we know that didn't end too well. He says, okay, I'm going to wait 10 generations. I'll try again to get the entire world with Noah and his ark. And that didn't go so well. But I'm going to show you, at each one of these stages, there was a restriction upon eating. But it was not a Jewish per se. It was for mankind was supposed to have a restriction on it. So let me show you. I have we'll start with the next part, the history of Kashrus. This is Bereishit, which is Genesis chapter 2. And the Lord God commanded man, saying, of every tree of the garden you may freely eat. You can have it's a smorgasbord, whatever you want. However, and if you remember, we spoke a lot about this, but the tree of knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for the day you eat from thereof you shall surely die. A restriction upon eating. This was the first commandment that was given, and it's fascinating. There is the Talmud from, based upon these verses, actually derives that each one of these phrases was hinting at a separate mitzvah that God had given Adam at that in this statement. You won't see it if you read the words. It just says God commanded him, eat all things, but it says many, many additional layers of meaning in the text based upon these verses. But, so you think that's it? I can't eat it? So look, let's go back to the next source in Bereishit chapter 1, Genesis. And God said, behold, I'm in verse number 29, behold, I've given you every seed-bearing herb, which is upon the surface of the entire earth, and every tree that has seed-bearing fruit, it will be yours for food. So there's plant life is allowed. But what's not allowed at this point? What's the one thing you can't have? Animals. So when do we stop becoming vegetarians? After Noah, right? After Noah. Now, there's two different understandings of why that changed. If I asked you, why do you think all of a sudden now you can have a hamburger? No cheeseburgers, but hamburgers are fine. Why can you have a hamburger after the flood? What are your thoughts? Any? Yeah?
Well, I mean, I guess because the land was flooded, there wasn't so much vegetation that
they okay.
could eat from.
I like that. Because you'll find, actually, interesting that Noah brought 7 kosher animals. He brought 2 of the non-kosher and 7 kosher ones. There was enough for a barbecue. You know, if you have a few kosher animals, you can, One opinion says that this was a reward for Noah. You have to imagine, every single species was crammed on that ark for a year. It stunk. Garbage. He had to feed them all. They had all sorts of crazy appetites that they wanted to eat. There's even a medrash that says there was one type of bird who only would eat glass. So Noah had to get glass for this bird. He fed all the animals. So one opinion says it was a reward. Hey, you did such a good job. Okay, have a hamburger. Have a steak, right? You're filet mignon, right? Because you did a good job. You worked hard. The others say no. And you need a little bit of a general survey through the years of people's lives. Before the flood, you have the person who lived the longest in the Bible. His name is Methuselah. He lived 969 years. Nobody lived longer than that. That's the longest. In English, they translate Methuselah, right? You heard the name Methuselah? So he was Methuselah. Adam, how long did Adam live for? Not 969, but he was pretty up there. Take a guess. 930. Let's fast forward now. After the flood, ages dropped significantly. Abraham lived 175 years, which is still pretty good, right? We'll take 175, but it's not 900. So there was a drastic change in the physical, what's what I'm looking for? The way the human beings were made. So therefore, there was a concession. Eating meat was now a concession. People weren't going to be as healthy. They needed the proteins. My wife had a friend that she was a vegetarian until she was pregnant with her first child. And the doctor says, the baby needs protein. You got to eat. So she stopped. She stopped her vegetarianism. Is that a word? I think it sounds good. Anyway, she stopped being a vegetarian and started eating meat because they needed it. So that's the other reason. So now if you look in the next one, Bereishit chapter 9, God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, and your fear and dread will be upon all the beasts of the earth, upon all the fowl of heaven, upon everything that creeps upon the ground, and upon all the fish of the sea, for they've been given into your hands. Meaning, you can now eat. You can now eat meat. So that was a further restriction. We'll see that not all types of meat were allowed. But the question really is why? Why is there a need for restriction upon what human beings eat? Well, every species has its own unique diet. If you were to give a dog a piece of rotten food, he'd enjoy every last bite. Human being would end up in the hospital. Depending upon the constitution of that species, there has to be a particular type of food that's custom-tailored for them to give them exactly what they need. The Jewish people have a unique spirituality, and we need to have a diet that hones us into that spirituality. If a person... Question? Yeah, sure.
No, not a question, a statement.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't it true that we eat more docile animals? We don't eat scavenger type.
That's correct.
Animals.
Excellent. I'm sorry, your first name again?
Leora.
Leora. So the commentators explained that when you eat an animal, literally, its blood of the animal comes into your blood, right? And we believe that the nefesh, you're talking about the neshama, right? That the soul of an animal is contained in its blood. So when I'm eating an animal, whatever character traits of that animal it possessed in its body, in its blood, and when I ingest it, I take its character traits into mine. So the Ramban, one of the medieval commentators, writes that animals that are cruel are not kosher. Now again, that's not the reason why they're not kosher, but you'll find that is a characteristic trait of them. Animals that abandon their birds, that abandon their young, are not kosher birds. There's 24 types of kosher birds, but those are like a stork, right, is an animal that abandons, it's not kosher. So the other type, as you're saying, those that are pursued but not pursuers, those are kosher animals, right? Lions, ligers, tigers, and bears, oh my, right, they're not kosher.
Not every part of the animal is kosher.
What part would not be kosher?
I thought that not every part, let's say of a cow is not kosher.
There are very few parts of the fats, but let's just say... So let's just keep it simple and say it's a kosher animal. Everything goes. Yeah. Let's just say everything goes.
We're not talking about fish yet, are we?
We can talk about fish.
I got a quick question.
Sure. So, I'm here all night.
Don't tempt Leora.
No, this is just something that we had a discussion about this in our Torah class. It was never really solved, I guess, about a swordfish, because a swordfish has scales in the water, but when it's out of the water, it doesn't have scales. So is it kosher if you eat it while it's still in the water?
How do you do that?
Sushi!
I think there's different species of swordfish, and I think it's actually defined by their tail. I think you have to look to the tail of the swordfish. I'm not positive, so I don't want to answer off the cuff, but I believe that is the where we check to see for the swordfish. I once heard a Rabbi Herschel Schachter, a very prominent rabbi at Yeshiva University, discuss this, and he was discussing the swordfish, but I apologize, I don't have it on instant recall, so I'll research it, I'll get you the answer, but I don't know off the top of my head. Swordfish. But you're right, no, scales and fins are the two requirements for a fish to be kosher.
In the water.
In general. Fish, they don't do twill out of the water. So let me kind of elaborate upon this idea of what we eat, how it affects us, since we started getting onto it for a minute. When the Rambam, Maimonides, codifies Jewish law, he has different books. And he has a book called Holiness, Kedusha. Now Kedusha, a little bit of Hebrew, what's the shorash? What's the root of the word Kedusha? Kuf, Dalid, Shin, right? Kadosh, holy. Where else do you find that word besides Kedusha, holiness? Think about it.
Kaddish.
Kaddish, excellent. Where else does it come up? Kiddush, Friday night, right? When one gets married, it's called Kiddushin. So all these words, Kuf, Dalid, Shin, literally means to separate and to designate. Let's take Kiddush. When I'm standing Friday night and I make Kiddush, I've now isolated and designated this as a holiness in time. I have divided the 6 days of the week and put Shabbos Kiddusha. Shabbos Kodesh, that's what we call it. Shabbos Kodesh, right? The holiness of Shabbos. When a man betroths himself, gets married to a woman, she betroths himself. So that's called Kiddushin. That bond between a husband and woman she is now separated from anybody else in the world. They've just like the 6 days a week are divided, she's now divided from everyone else. She's only allowed to be with her husband. There's a bond that's connected by isolating and separating it. When we talk about Kedusha, holiness, many more examples of this, when we talk about the concept of holiness, that's where the Rambam, Maimonides, puts the laws of eating. He puts the laws of eating in the section dealing with holiness. As I said a few minutes ago, the average person on the street isn't thinking of holiness as how they eat. And the Rambam, the code of Jewish law that's based upon, tells us that's exactly where it belongs. That our holiness depends on how we eat and what we eat. And let's just say it's not enough just to sit and stuff our faces with kosher cheesecake all day long. We have to eat like a mensch. Thank God for the food that we have, and it has to be kosher. If a person would go to a rock concert, right, and you're sitting, you know, imagine you got the front row seats, right? So your eardrums get shot after a night, right? Madison Square Garden, you're right? Metallica, right? The band, right?
How do you know Metallica?
How do I know Metallica? I teach high school. Don't worry. Okay, so the next night, you want to go to Avery Fisher Hall, the New York Philharmonic, right? So how are your eardrums going to be after one night listening? They're done. Can you hear the flute in the back? No, the woodwinds, it's not there. You don't have the proper receptacle to hear it because you damaged your eardrums by listening to Metallica. If a person eats food, they have to be very careful that they don't damage their spiritual radar, their spiritual eardrums. Because as sensitive as we are to godliness, to holiness, to goodness, what we eat is who we are. The types of animals, Leora pointed out, you have to be careful as to what animals you eat because we want to be docile. We want to be sensitive people. And if I put that into my body, so it's not just, oh, okay, it goes into the bloodstream. It's who I am. Literally, like the joke, you are what you eat. 100%. We 100% are what we eat, so we have to be very careful. Now, let me show you that this is really said explicitly in the verse, and the next one is Shmos. Shmos is means the book of Exodus, chapter 22. This is talking about non-kosher food. You shall be a holy people. So here, God himself puts holiness into the laws of the commandments of keeping kosher. Flesh torn in the field you shall not eat, you shall throw it to the dogs. So Rashi, again, a little bit of background, Rashi was the greatest commentator on the Torah. You can't blink without learning a Rashi. Rashi helps, he leads us by the hand. You know, he's your best friend when learning the Torah. Rashi is there to guide us through. So Rashi's commentary is accepted by everybody. So Rashi says, you'll be a holy people to me if you are holy and abstain from the loathsomeness of eating carrion and mortally injured animals, you're mine. If you keep kosher and you avoid those things that you should not be involved with, you're with me. But if not, you're not mine. That's how you connect to me. God says, I want you to be thing. I want you to follow me. That's why it's not just a Jewish concept of restrictions on foods. He gave it to Adam, the first human being from all of mankind comes from. He gave it to Noah when he tried to recreate the world again, starting literally fresh. Because there's this aspect of the importance of what we eat. So much so that affects whether we're connected to God or not. See, who cares? Who cares? Say, does. In the Vayikra, which is the book of Leviticus, on the next one, chapter 11, you shall not make yourselves abominable with any creeping creature that creeps. You shall not defile yourselves. You shall not become unclean through them. For I am the Lord your God, and you'll sanctify yourselves and become holy. For I am holy. So again, this idea of holiness is so bound up into eating. A most basic human need, where everyone needs to eat, but that it can be elevated. And that's the beautiful thing about Judaism, that every single aspect of my life, literally from how I wake up in the morning to how I put my shoes on in the morning to how I conduct myself in the bathroom to how I conduct myself in the business, in the workplace, at home, in the synagogue, everything has the potential to become elevated. You know, and in other religions you have your holy people, but they're like isolated, you know, like, I mean, again, the priest, he's like the holy guy, like everyone else just does, you know, they do whatever they do, but they have their holy. In Judaism, it doesn't mean the rabbi is the holiest person. Anybody could be. The honest businessman is holy. Holiness, kedusha, is accessible and required from everybody. It's not like, oh, like I'm not. You know, they tell a story about a guy who was like hiding out behind on Yom Kippur. He was like caught in the back, like eating some like ham and cheese sandwich. The rabbi says, "What are you doing here?" He says, "It's okay. I'm in the Secret Service." I'm not in your service. I'm in the Secret Service. Everybody has an opportunity. And the laws of keeping kosher are so bound up. Let me show you. I have another quote here just to read this. Again, I apologize. It's not on your things. This is from a Rav Ezra Bick. Again, a rabbi in Israel. He says, there are different concepts that are combined here based upon these verses. Holiness, impurity, and separation. The verb havdil, right? Now, havdil, what word does that sound like? Havdalah, to separate. We make kiddush, we make holiness when we enter into Shabbat, and when Shabbat is over, we make havdalah, to separate. It's repeated a number of times as being the activity that's been commanded by God when he gave us the laws of forbidden foods. Aside from any particular understanding of a given category of forbidden foods, these verses indicate a major element in the very idea of forbidden foods. Man is commanded to distinguish, to separate between that which is before him. In a striking correlation, God says to Jews, you must separate between animals, as I have separated you from the nations. The very existence of Israel is based upon separation, distinction. And this is reflected in a basic Jewish activity, separation and distinction within the world that's before us. So that's really some of the background in general. But I'd like now move to talk some of the some of the rationales for reasons that are provided by the commentators for this. If you turn to the next page, where it says the physical benefits. Okay, so let's now again. I just want to make a big disclaimer. Even though there are reasons given for keeping kosher, at the end of the day, that's not the defining reason. Even if we cannot, or even if we have questions on this, we'll ask some very strong questions on some of the reasons that are given by the sources. So the Rambam wrote a book called Guide for the Perplexed. It's a work called Mora Nevuchim. Mora Nevuchim was a response that a lot of Jews were influenced by Aristotle, were influenced by Islamic philosophy, and they didn't know what ideas are Jewish and what ideas are not Jewish. So the very first section of this book deals with a phrase that we are familiar with. It says that we were created B'Tselem Elokim, in the image of God. So if I stopped and said, what does that mean to be created in the image of God? Does that mean that God's physical? Right? No? He's like probably 5'2". He's got blonde hair, blue eyes. You know, God's, if we're creating God's image, there must be a physical form. So the Rambam's, the very first piece in his Guide to the Perplexed is to come explain what does it mean? No, God doesn't have a form. That's not what it means. But he had to explain and talk about it. So in here he starts talking about keeping kosher. And the Rambam, Maimonides, says that the reason is because it's a health issue. Pork, swine, they're filthy, disgusting animals. He writes, it's a health reason, it's a physical benefit. I'll read to you. I maintain that the food which is forbidden by law is unwholesome. There's nothing among the forbidden kinds of food whose injurious character is doubted except pork and fat. But even in these cases, the doubt is not justified, for pork contains more moisture than necessary for human food and too much of superfluous matter. The principal reason why the law forbids swine's flesh is to be found in the circumstance that its habits and its food are very dirty and loathsome. Okay, so the Rambam says it's not healthy. Now again, that's very questionable, because I could find a lot of Jews who keep the laws of kosher and are not healthy people. Right? You can go to the local kosher supermarket here, and I'll show you the candy aisle. It's got mountains of chocolate, mountains of sugar. And just because a thing is kosher, we were joking earlier about having a good steak. Okay, so what happens if you have 2, 3, 4, 6 servings of steak? The French fries, and you just can't have your dinner because you went to the kosher pizza store. You went to Giddy's Kosher Pizza in East Brunswick for lunch, right? A person could be kosher, keep all the laws, but it doesn't mean that they're going to be healthy, and then you flip it. You ask the question, and what happens when you have a healthy non-Jew? They have the shakes, I don't know what these things are called, the protein things, they're very healthy. So if the Rambam is telling us the rationale behind why we keep kosher because it's healthy, I could point to empirical evidence that contradicts that. I could find Jews who keep kosher who are not necessarily so healthy. I could find non-Jews who don't keep kosher who are healthy. And what's even more than that, the Abar Banel, I believe, has a very strong question on this. He says, you're telling me that's the reason for keeping kosher? Excellent. You know what you just did? You just reduced God's Torah to a health book, to a diet, the South Beach diet, right? He gave you a good diet plan. It's keeping kosher. The Torah's not a diet book. It's not Weight Watchers. The Torah is God's wisdom to us. So they quote the Rambam, and they argue on the Rambam. So the next reason I'll show you is the Ramban, which is what, again, Leroy was talking about, that the types of animals. Even the types of animals, I'm on the next source now, we are chosen in part for their symbolism. The ruminants that have split hooves tend to be tranquil, domesticated animals that have no natural weapons. Right? These are calm, you know? These are calm animals. Characteristics we may absorb through eating. We may not eat scavengers, carnivores, or birds of prey. These are not characteristics that we want to absorb at all. So that's a very important reason as well, that it's a mystical reason. But it's important to keep in mind. Okay, the next one is the Abar Banel. Another aspect of, the next source was a spiritual impact. Another aspect of the kosher laws is the encouragement of a certain degree of aesthetic sensitivity. Judaism prohibits the consumption of animals that have died of natural causes and animals that are deformed or deceased, as well as prohibiting the consumption of insects and loathsome foods. It's possible that one idea, again, he doesn't say this is, just it's possible, that one idea behind this is to encourage us to view ourselves with dignity and to act with dignity. One of the best defenses against doing something that's just immoral is a strong sense of self-esteem and dignity. Evil should be looked at as beneath our dignity. Stealing is stooping too low. Gossip is petty and small-minded. In order to help us achieve and maintain this level of dignity, the Torah prohibits foods like carcasses and diseased animals. Through this, we hope to fulfill the verse that says, and you'll be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. So, a refined person eats refined foods, right? By the way, just a side point, I was shocked to learn that the Queen of England enjoys sardines. Did you know this? I didn't know this either. But it actually comes up in halacha that whether it's important to know whether the Queen of England eats sardines or not. Why, that'd be a different topic for maybe another time. But
are sardines kosher?
Yes, yes. Sardines are kosher. But one of there's actually a technical law of a type of food that would only be served at a king's table. And many thought for years that sardines would not be fall into that category because no king would ever eat sardines, you know, and they found out that the Queen of England at her tea time has sardines, and this changed the halacha because sardines really went onto a royal table. Okay, let's move on. A life with borders. But again, I think let me summarize that. Just for point is that if you look at yourself as being royalty, which the Jewish people are, So then we eat like royalty. And, you know, you wouldn't expect, you know, you're driving upstate New York, right? And you see, like, my kids like spot roadkill. It's like a little card game to pass time. I don't know. But no one says, oh, roadkill, great, let's pull over. I'm hungry for lunch. Ach und weh, right? But you have to understand that this is all creating a sensitivity towards us. That I'm a refined person. I'm above that. I don't stoop to that level. So that's the second reason of the sensitivity it creates within us. The Akedas Yitzchak talks about a life with borders. So I'll tell you a story that it's true. And then I saw this story I found on online. There was an African American woman who was in line at a supermarket, and her son was grabbing something, and she screamed at him, "Tyrone, you put that candy bar down right now! It's not kosher." And like everyone just looked at this lady, like, you know, what just happened here? And like, what? So then apparently someone had enough chutzpah to go over and ask, "Excuse me, I couldn't help it over here. You scream at your kid to put down the candy bar. It's not kosher. Are you Jewish?" She goes, "No." But I hear all the Jewish mothers say to their kids and it works, so I figured it'll work on my kid also. It's a true story. So why does that work? Why does that work? So let me read you, then we'll come back to it in a second. The most obvious idea behind the kosher laws is self-control and discipline. Let me illustrate with this idea with a real-life example. Most parents are familiar with the horror of going to the supermarket with young children. The worst part of this ordeal is waiting in line at the checkout counter. You have only 5 items, including the 2 items the child in the shopping cart swiped off the shelves without your knowledge. So you wait in the 8 items or less express line. The lady in front of you has 25 items at least. She's trying to pay with a third-party check from Paraguay. You're waiting with 2 children under the age of 6, surrounded on both sides by 4-foot-high canyon walls of sugar-based products. The children becoming increasingly impatient and begging for candies, and you're becoming more and more angry and frustrated as time goes on. Of course, most children will scream and beg and embarrass their parents into buying the candy. But now for the true story. I moved with my family from Israel to Toronto for a 4-year stay, and the first week was waiting in line at the supermarket, as described above, more or less, with one of my children. He asked me for a chocolate bar. I looked at the bar and told him it was not kosher. Really, it wasn't kosher. And he was silent, accepting the decision without tantrums, threats, tears, or hysteria. It struck me then that my 5-year-old, who's been brought up with the laws of kashrut, has more self-control than millions of adults in the Western world. How many people accept no as an answer in denial of the pleasure they want now? That's what it's all about. It's about a lifestyle that I don't just take whatever I want whenever I want it. The laws of kosher are very complex. They're not impossible, but one learns them. It says, it's not only what I eat, but I can have kosher meat and I can have kosher milk. I have to wait 6 hours between them. But I'm hungry, I want my ice cream now. I'm sorry, I need to wait. Judaism teaches us through the midst of keeping kosher, self-control. And there's a fascinating experiment, you might be familiar with it, it was done in the 1960s in Stanford. It's called the marshmallow experiment. You ever heard this? The marshmallow experiment. They the following, the kids were observed, I think the kids were around the age of maybe 4, 5, not much older or younger, and they told the kids like this: I have one marshmallow in front of you. I'm going out of the room. If you can wait until I come back, I'll give you a second marshmallow. And they don't tell the kid how long they're going to be gone for. And the person walks out, and they've actually, you can like find this on YouTube, they have like these kids are just like looking at the marshmallow, and like some of them like sitting on their hands and squirming not to eat the marshmallow, and some of them like licking it and then putting it back down, and those kids like picking off like a little piece under the bottom, like stuffing them out there, and one kid just comes off. Right? So okay, then they come back, delayed gratification. They found, this was in the 1960s, they found that those children who were able to wait versus those who weren't, this was the single greatest criterion in determining success, more than SAT scores, more than a person's affluence, more than the level of parental education. The single most defining factor whether a child was successful later on in life is could they delay the gratification. That's Kashrus 101. Ah, oh, but I want it to look so good. I'm sorry, it's not kosher. So that's some of the ideas behind that we become more sensitive. And that's the purpose, is to grow, to climb that ladder of spirituality. Just to end off with in the last page, on the conclusion. Judaism sees the human as an essentially spiritual being, clothed in a physical body. Judaism maintains that physical is not evil, it's just not the complete view of reality. Judaism seeks to elevate the physical world, not deny it, nor to glorify it. The laws of kashrut allow us to enjoy the pleasures of the physical world, but in such a way that we sanctify and elevate the pleasure through consciousness and sensitivity. I thought that's a beautiful way to take home message for what it means about keeping kosher. We're involved in the world. We're real. We're human beings. We're a composite of body and of soul. And we have to do food that sanctifies and elevates our body and our soul. And throughout one's growth, it's important to learn the reasons for the mitzvot. But even at the end of the day, if I can't find the reason, or this one resonates with me, this one not so much, at the end of the day, that's not why we keep the mitzvot. We don't keep them because we could filter God into our small little perception. We keep mitzvot because this is what God wants from us. But in our journey, in our growth, for learning more and growing and accepting upon us and taking small baby steps, so kashrut is a key thing because it's the doorway to sensitivity. In the example we gave about the Metallica concert, you kill your eardrums. So unfortunate, a person eats non-kosher food, it destroys their sensitivity. Two people who go to the same lecture, one person can be so inspired by another person, what's the difference? They ate ribs. They, one ate ribs and one ate, one ate Huber National and one had, you know, it's all about having your spiritual ear lids open. And that's really what kashrus does for it. It provides us with the tools necessary to lead meaningful, productive, fulfilling lives. So again, thank you. Are there any questions? I'm happy to, yeah.
One quick,
sure.
Real quick.
Sure.
So,